Good afternoon. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Saturday, September 11th, 2021. The time is 2 p.m. Please silence all cell phones, and I would ask everyone to stand up in the room for a minute. We're going to take a moment of observance for the September 11th victims, those of the deceased and those that rushed in to the line of defense. Thank you. Members present today are Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hoffman, and Co-Chair Stedman, and Senator Olson, I believe, is en route.
Mr. Chairman, I'm on the line.
Someone's online.
Senator Olson, is that you? You're online?
Yes, of course. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm online.
Thank you. And Senator Welikowski is online as well. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So this morning, or this afternoon, excuse me, we will hear today's agenda. We're going to hear from Angela Rodell, Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And then we're going to have a presentation from Mr. Lexi Painter discussing PFD modeling scenarios. And we will hear no bills today. We're just going to look at the modeling this afternoon. So, Ms. Rodell, would you please come forward? And I believe we had a question or two from yesterday that we're going to have you respond to, Senator Stedman. We'll put out herself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and I'm here to answer questions.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yesterday, we had a presentation and discussion here at the table, the Department of Revenue. And as I recall, there was this discussion on the need under certain scenarios of an overdraw of the permanent fund over the 5% payout cap that we have and we've been following. And it was insinuated that it doesn't really matter if we go over the 5%. It's okay for these type of funds, these big endowment funds or whatever, to breach that amount. And it wouldn't it'd have minimal or no effect on the permanent fund. And I, for one, could not correlate that back to other presentations that we've had, particularly from the permanent fund. So I thought it'd be nice, Mr. Chairman, if we had representations from the permanent fund to refresh the memory of the committee on is there any impacts or concerns if we started doing ad hoc draws on the permanent fund as far as any management, lost opportunity cost, or anything else we should be aware of. And if Ms. Rodell, if you could help us with that, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm going to take a step back and maybe just sort of slowly walk through how we manage the fund to help illustrate and answer that question. The corporation statutes have not been touched other than to put in the prudent investor rule in 2005. Prior to that, there was a list of investments that the Board of Trustees were allowed to use to invest the funds. But all the rest of the statutes, the legislative findings, have been in place since 1980. And that includes our mission, which is to manage and invest the funds entrusted to us. It also includes the legislative findings, which is that we are to maximize return and we are to minimize risk. And we are to ensure that there is a intergenerational effect as a result. So that, in other words, none of the actions that the trustees take causes a loss that would impair future generations of Alaskans from benefiting from the fund. So with that as our foundation, each year the Board of Trustees works very diligently on an asset allocation. And that asset allocation is designed to both maximize that return, which they have as a long-term target of 5% real return, so 5% plus inflation, and to also think about the risk associated with that and how best to mitigate the risk associated with that asset allocation. We have under our care, think of it as a bucket of funds. It's the principal, it's the earnings reserve account, it's the mental health trust money, and it's the Amaretta Hess settlement, which spins off income for the Alaska Capital Income Fund. So according to the direction we have been given in statute, we are to invest everything like the permanent fund. So we put everything in a bucket, and we do an asset allocation, and we make that investment. Currently, the asset allocation is 38% to stocks, 20% to bonds, which gets you to about 58%. There's a 2% allocation to cash, and then the balance of 40% are in private alternative assets, like real estate, like private equity, like private income. And when we set that allocation, not only are we taking into account return and risk, we are assuming that the bucket is going to be a certain size. And when there are ad hoc, unplanned draws of the magnitude that have been discussed, it significantly decreases the size of the bucket. All of that money in those draws will come out of the public side of the investments. So in other words, in order to make the cash payments to the state, we'll use the public equity portfolio, stock portfolio, bond portfolio, cash portfolio. And that's because it's very easy to generate the liquidity on that side. But the effect is that now you have what we would call an overweight. We have too much money as a result of that in that private side of the allocation. So we have too much money in real estate, too much money in private equity. And that has a very different risk profile than what was intended. And to start to diminish or decrease our exposure to that alternative side takes 1 to 2 years. And so we really encourage the known draw amounts because we're trying to manage this long-term investment and we're trying to manage it in a risk-adjusted way so as not to get upside down, so to speak, in our asset allocation and in our risk tolerance and in the returns. And just to give you an idea, private equity for fiscal year 21 returned 69% versus 48% on the public equity side. So these are meaningful investments that have returned incredible wealth to the state, but they can't be unwound quickly or easily, and they take resources. And so trying to manage that in a state of uncertainty, and I haven't even addressed what would happen if the market went down at the same time, which also would cause unintended consequences. So I hope, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, that that helps clarify how difficult it could be to manage, because the effect would be to have to move more than we intend out of those buckets in order to assume things that may or may not happen in terms of ad hoc draws.
Follow up,
Senator? Yeah, I've got a couple little ones on that. So we have a piece of legislation here in front of the table, SB 53, and the current draft that was on the table the other day was to have a 1.5% overdraw for 2 years. Was this significant? Going from 5 to 6.5, or at what point should we be paying attention to it?
Through the chair, Senator Simmons, that's a really tough question to answer. I'll be honest, because I think, you know, it's the legislature's responsibility to set policy on how the reserves are going to get spent. The trustees have advocated for years now and reaffirmed it in 2020 that to keep balances in the earnings reserve account of 4 times the draw amount to help cushion and plan for this. When SB 26, the current POMV statutes were being discussed, we talked about 5.25% for 3 years, stepping down to 5% to help provide a glide path down. We are now at the point where it's 5%. So I think it's just a really difficult conversation to have because the state's in the position it's in to decide what's prudent on this front.
I guess
follow up.
Maybe garble up the question, but if we were to want the permanent fund to produce that extra half, or we start drawing out the extra 1.5% for 2 years, is that going to impact your management strategy? And then I'd also like you to elaborate a little bit on the history of the last couple of years' performance, in that you did mention that you had significant positive performance returns this last year, but if they're way off the mean to the positive of the permanent fund. So should we be a little more cautious that these returns are going to regress to the mean, or are we going to stay in the 20 to 30% annual returns for the next several years?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think you highlight an important point. Fiscal year 2020, a year ago, we ended the fiscal year earning 2.04%. So if you think July 1, 2019 through June 30th, 2020, it was a really challenging year. In March of 2020, the value of the fund dropped to $60 billion at one point. We were fortunate that we were able to recover, be able to put cash into the market to recover and achieve the returns that we received over this past year. All of our consultants that we work with are advising us that we should expect a much lower return environment over the next 10 years, that where we're at all-time high valuations across all asset classes, it will be difficult to sustain that level of return. And in fact, I will tell you that in my 30-year career, these are the highest returns I've ever seen, ever. So I think that should highlight just how rare and how lucky and grateful we are to have something like the fund that was able to take that opportunity. I apologize, I'm answering your second part of your question, but I'm drawing a blank now on the first part of your question, if you wouldn't mind repeating that.
You answered that they're kind of, they tie together as far as having huge returns the last year, taking a couple of overdraws when we're looking forward into regressing back more towards the mean returns, which are substantially lower than the previous 12 months. So I'll let someone else ask some questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Just to build upon Senator Stedman, of when you have 5%, which is generally the prevailing rate across endowments and foundations across the world and sovereign wealth funds. What we're seeing, and I just want to reiterate, can you recall, what does the mental health trust draw rate? Do you recall that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'd have to go back and double check. It's either 4.25% or 4.75%, but I don't want to put, it's less than 5%.
Exactly, thank you. When you attend national and international conferences with other endowments, foundations, and sovereign wealth funds, what generally is the draw rate on these funds? Can you comment on that?
Through the chair, a number of sovereign wealth funds will have variable draw rates under certain conditions. So they will set certain limiters based on GDP growth, on other things happening within their sovereignty, for lack of a better way to describe it. But in general, they range between 3% and 5%.
One last question.
Please.
And then what did Norway just recently do with their rate? Do you recall?
Through the chair, they increased the rate from 3% to 4%.
But they continue, but I believe that in the last couple of years, they dropped it from 5 to 4, or if I recall. The rate generally is below 5, and I believe they have not pierced 5.
Through the chair, it's my understanding that they could go to 5, but they have not, which is why when I spoke with the fund 2 weeks ago, they were talking about how they had been historically at 3%, and they were increasing it this year to 4.
One last comment, Mr. Chairman, is thank you for that, Ms. Rodelli. Appreciate it. The federal government for private foundations and endowments assumes the maximum draw is 5%, and all excise taxes on grants given on an annual basis is based on a 5% giveaway. And that's because 5% is the tried and true tested draw amount across decades, if not generations, as sustainable over time. So I just wanted to place that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Senator Olson or Senator Wilikowski, either of you got a question at this point?
No questions.
Just to kind of recapitulate, Ms. Rodell, what you said several minutes ago. We talked about the bill that's not on the table, but it's in the Finance Committee today, but about the 1.5% overdraw. And I heard you say that it would take the corporation 2 years to unwind some of these asset allocations, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, in order to rebalance the portfolio to the risk and return allocation that the board has set, it would take up to 2 years to reduce the exposure to private assets to get it back into that asset allocation.
And would there, on this rebalance, if you can't answer it, don't, just let it go, but is there the potential from lost opportunity cost by going to 6.5 versus just leaving it at 5?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a potential for opportunity costs in the sense of you're taking money out of some of the highest, best performing assets of the fund and putting them into lower risk, lower returning assets by the nature of rebalancing. And so there is a potential effect of that, of lost return.
Thank you. And Senator Von Emhoff, question.
Thank you. I just think that the other factor we should consider, if and we do discuss increasing the draw rates in whatever fashion, is that we need to generate returns to cover our 5% draw, as well as inflation. So if inflation is 3%, then the permanent fund needs to generate at least a minimum of 8%, even just to hold steady, to avoid eroding the value of the dollar. If inflation goes up, which it has been, and if we begin to take more than 5%, then those return hurdles increase as well. And I think it just becomes harder and harder for the foundation, for the permanent fund team, to meet the return goals.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members before we go to our next presenter? Seeing none at the tape, Senator Stedman.
One quick thing. I want to thank Ms. Rodell for hanging around earlier this morning while we're juggling our schedule and waiting for CSs and analysis to be done and other things. So I really appreciate that on Saturday. And I know there's other things you could be doing today on your day off than coming here. So it's very well appreciated. But I was wondering if the $4 billion this year that we appropriated at this table from the non-constitutionally protected side to the constitutionally protected side of the permanent fund, so it cannot be spent. And I think that pushes that value up around maybe $60 billion or so. I was wondering if you could briefly comment on that, because it was one of the most significant things for future generations that this table has done, along with the check behind the committee here on the wall from 2 years previous at $4.9 billion. So I hate to ask you to reformat some of your charts and your presentations for our contributions into that arena, but we're changing your y-axis.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the $4 billion that was appropriated in the FY22 budget that took effect July 1st, that money moved right away because of the way that budgetary language was drafted. So it, for those who are financial statement geeks and go to our website and look at our July 31 statements, which are out right now, they'll see the effect of that transfer and see that we have a total in the principal of the fund of $66.2 billion. That includes $15.2 billion of unrealized gain. So really the core corpus is $50.9 billion after that transfer, and that's where we sit on that protected portion today.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I echo Senator Stedman's comments on coming in on Saturday. And seeing no further questions, Senator Wilikowski, did you have anything before we let Ms. Rodell go, or Senator Olson?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Tell Finn hello for us.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll have Mr. Painter, our alleged finance analyst, director. Please put yourself on the record and continue. Start your presentation.
Turn the screen.
Yep, it's on.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So I was asked to present a few scenarios of for the PFT and fiscal modeling. And before we get into the scenarios themselves, these were, again, requested by the co-chairs, not LFD is policy neutral and doesn't endorse any particular fiscal plan.
Can we have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Back on the record, and just for clarification, this modeling that Mr. Painter's bringing forth is kind of a precursor to what the Senate Bill 53 is attempting to achieve in the CS that will be forthcoming. And we're hoping to set the stage for that discussion when it hits the table. Senator Stebbins, do you have any other comments?
Yeah, just briefly to the public watching so they can make it maybe easier to follow along. Several years ago when we were struggling with some of the budgets and we're looking at not only the dividend issue, but at that point in time we're looking at education funding also. We forward funded education for a year, and that lasted for several years until such time as it was unfortunately expensed. And then also we set the dividend for a couple of years in advance. And that helped get a pretty good idea of what we were dealing with coming at us. And it's not too dissimilar, but at a much bigger magnitude today, where we're looking at rewriting the dividend formula because it's 40 years old and it's out of sync and structurally with the composition of the permanent fund and the size. So we've got a piece of legislation in front of us that the committee is considering, and the committee's been working on a substantial CS, taking that concept that we've used a couple of times in the past and applying it, where we are going to have a CS that's going to recommend for consideration prior to amendments, of course, that we set a dividend rate at $1,100, then $1,200, and then $1,300, and then it will, if the revenue is generated, sufficient enough to pay the 50-50 dividend split on the permanent fund, has been talked about a lot in the press, basically taking the 5% payout rate and breaking it in half to the dividends, half to the state, then that would trigger that. If not, the dividend would revert back to the base of $1,300 and grow at roughly inflation. And this is a starting point. So this is what we're attempting to have modeled for the committee and the public. That's going to be presented here. As mentioned by the chairman, the CS is in final edit. It's not quite ready. We're still, got to review it some more, obviously, for any typos and things like that. So unfortunately, it's not on the table, but with the clock advancing so quickly on this special session, we thought that the chairman and myself thought that it would be best to get this information in front of the committee so the committee could have a presentation from Legislative Finance on the financial implications and give it some consideration even before they get the CS. And then we'll redo this again, I think, when we have the CS, the committee substitute that has it in language format, and then commence our discussion and amendments from committee members as we try to work forward to a solution to the dividend formula and challenge for the people of the state. And hopefully, when we do conclude this, whenever that is, and restate the dividend policy, it'll stand 30 or 40 years like the current statute has before it needed to be reviewed and changed. So I just wanted to kind of lay that out along with the chairman a little bit. So there's a little background to what we're going to walk through here in the next several pages. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. And before you start, Mr. Painter, we want to recognize Representative Ortiz, Representative Josephson, Senator Schauer. If you'd like a seat over here at the table, Senator Schauer, please come and have a seat. Mr. Painter.
Okay, so continuing, before going to the scenarios, we're going to review our modeling baselines. These are the same as what this committee saw, I think about 2 weeks ago or so in our presentation, so they should be familiar, but for members of the public, we'll just go over that again. So our fiscal model is designed to show policymakers the long-term impact of fiscal policy decisions. So our baseline assumption is essentially that the current budget levels are maintained, adjusted for inflation. So then policy changes would be applied against that baseline. And our default is to assume that statutory formulas will be followed. So for revenue, our assumption is to use the Department of Revenue spring forecast, which assumes $61 oil in FY22, growing with inflation in future years. That also incorporates DNR's oil production forecast, which projects an increase in production over the next 10 years from 459,000 barrels per day in FY22 to 565,000 barrels by FY30. For the permanent fund, we are assuming actual FY21 returns, and then going forward, the return assumptions by Callan which is 5.86% for FY22 and then 6.2% for FY20 and beyond. I note that there's been a minor update since the last time we presented a couple of weeks ago, because we have final numbers from the permanent fund, which actually increased the value slightly above what we had shown before.
Mr. Painter, before we move off of that, have we double checked back with the administration to ask them if that took into account what's happened with Willow?
Mr. Chairman, the spring forecast was based on DNR's production forecast from last fall, so it does not take into account that new activity or the changes in that field. The fall forecast that will be released likely this December will incorporate that. I'd note that new fields don't provide a lot of revenue because of the gross value reduction, so even delaying a new field by a few years doesn't make a huge impact on revenue, even though the production number may shift a bit.
Thank you. Any other questions before we go to the next slide? Seeing none, please continue.
Okay, moving on to slide 5, so our spending assumptions. For agency operations, we're assuming that agency operations end up midway between the conference committee budget and the enacted budget, which is with vetoes. And there's about a $50 million difference between those two, so it's about $25 million above the enacted budget. I would note that in House Bill 3003, that's in front of this committee as well, there's additional FY22 appropriations, but it's a little lower than that $25 million at this point. For statewide items, our baseline assumes that all items are funded to their statutory levels beyond FY22. So we're using the enacted budget in FY22 and then the statutory levels in future years. Again, with House Bill 3003, depending on how that turns out, that assumption may have to shift a little bit because there's some funding for statewide items in that bill. In future years, we assume, again, the statutory formulas. So we assume that oil and gas tax credits, if we don't fund them this year, would be funded in future years. So that just sort of push out that liability. We have a baseline of fund transfers that represents the ongoing cost of DEC's spill prevention response program that goes through fund transfers. For the capital budget, we're assuming this year's enacted capital budget growing with inflation. That budget was about $240 million UGF, a bit larger than capital budgets in previous years. The governor had vetoed significant amounts from that, but it's still larger than the last few years, and so we're just assuming that growing with inflation. And then we have a baseline supplemental assumption of $50 million per year based on the average amount of supplemental appropriations minus lapsing funds each year. So try to take into account that not everything gets spent, but also we often have to add to the budget.
Thank you. And just on that capital budget point, now we know if and when the infrastructure package comes, we're going to have to do our reasonable and customary match for those funds. So thank you.
Okay, so a quick note on retirement funding. Again, this is review for the committee, so I'll go pretty quickly. But generally, LFD uses whatever the ARM board, the Retirement Management Board, recently adopted. However, because of the record-breaking earnings in FY21, using numbers from that don't take that into account overstate the liability. And so ARM board meetings later this month will adopt updated projections, and what we've heard is that they'll resemble preliminary projections that DOR ran in July more closely than our normal assumption. So this presentation will use those preliminary estimates that DOR created in July, and hopefully we'll have finalized numbers from the ARM board within the next few weeks. And the impact of those FY21's earnings is a significantly lower liability going forward, as we can see on slide 7. So the first column there is our previous assumption, $245 million growing to $323 million. The July draft numbers from DOR show $180 million and then dropping down to $108 million by FY26, then growing slightly. on a year-to-year basis, these reductions are somewhere in the start at $65 million and increase to $205 million by FY30. And cumulatively, this change in assumptions reduces the budget by $1.26 billion over the forecast period.
Mr. Chairman?
I'd just like to make a point that Senator Hoffman, I think, was here with Senator McKinnon, and the wisdom to put $3 billion in this fund, what, six, seven, 8 years ago, that number wouldn't look like that if this table hadn't have made that deposit, because we were looking at projections of up to $1.2 billion a year to satisfy our legal obligation. Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. I understand that the ARM board reviews this chart periodically, like twice a year, once a year, do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, they will review these numbers four times a year, so they meet June, September, December, and March.
Follow up. So this obviously looks wildly different 6 months ago, 4 months ago, than it does as of July, and it could very well, if the past is our guide, the prediction or the change every 4 months, even on a, if we just did on an annual basis, is relatively significant, especially if we're talking $150+ million a year. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, this is an unusually large swing from year to year, but yes, there is some volatility. There is averaging that they do, so it's a, kind of a five-year average, so there is some smoothing. But even still, with a year that's so far above the actuarial projection as FY21, it can move those numbers very quickly in just 1 year.
One last comment. Just one last comment. So if the market does swing down to what it was last year, Ms. Rodell was saying something like 2 to 3% returns, we could see this chart adjusting yet again in the other direction.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to note on that dovetail on Senator Von Imhoff's comment that we've already been down that road once before, 1999, I believe, and I'm hoping we don't make the same mistake twice. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on both those comments, clearly in the end of in the 1990s, they were underfunding the pension plan, late 80s or what have you, and turned it upside down, and we're paying for that price or that cost today. And then again, when we, a decade or so ago, a little bit before that, we reduced our expenditures into it and helped turn it upside down some more. So I would caution the committee to take these numbers with a grain of salt. We'll look at them again in February or March, and we'll run some sensitivity tables on them, and we'll take a look at them. But clearly the returns in the financial markets regress to the mean, and we, and if you have a 25 or 30% return in 1 year, you're going to have some ugly returns coming at you to regress that down into the mean. So, you know, I would just take it with a grain of salt. Hopefully we can have these budgetary reductions, $65 million or so this year, or next upcoming budget, maybe more, but let's make sure we continue to advance the shrinkage of the unfunded liability and not make any historical mistakes that were made in the 90s on the pension plan.
Mr. Painter, please continue.
Okay, so going on to the first scenario. So this first scenario shows essentially a stair-step PFD and no other policy changes. So in FY22 and 23, this has a $1,100 PFD. In FY24, it's $1,200 PFD, FY25, $1,300. And then starting in FY26, it goes to the 50-50 formula. And again, this is with no other policy changes from our baseline. So this shows that we would have deficits in FY21, 22, 23, and then a roughly balanced budget in FY24, 25. Then when the 50-50 POMV kicks in, there'd be a $700 million deficit. I would note that this assumes that we don't use any future American Rescue Plan Act revenue replacement, which we did $250 million of this year, so that overdraw you see in FY23 could probably be avoided if we use a similar amount for revenue replacement next year. We'd roughly balance the budget in FY23.
Questions? Committeemen online, any questions on this slide? Hearing none, please continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide shows the same scenario, but instead of using the Callan forecast for the permanent fund, we're using the actual returns from FY 2000 through 2008. That incorporates the dot-com bust in those early couple of years, so some negative market performance. And you can see that compared to the last scenario, the budget deficits look a little worse. Instead of a roughly $700 million deficit, it's in FY26, $780 million. And in this scenario, the ERA drops before recovering after the recession period. So again, similar results in the first couple of years because those FY22 and 23 POMV numbers are already fixed based on prior performance, but then a little bit worse performance in the next few years due to building in that historical recession. Okay, seeing no questions.
Next slide.
No questions, we'll go on to slide 10. So this shows the same scenario with the actual returns from FY09 through 17. So this is kind of an extreme stress test where you get the single worst year of the fund's history, FY09, when we've had negative statutory net income. And then essentially a recovery through the next few years, although with a little bit of a dip in between as well. And you can see in this scenario, we have a deficit each year, even in the years FY24, 25, where in the other two scenarios we had a balanced budget. In this one, we'd have deficits throughout the period. And then by FY26, instead of a $700 million deficit, it would be more like $900 million in this scenario.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So essentially putting it all together, looking at slide 8, 9, and 10, you are modeling the exact same assumptions other than the only thing difference is the returns. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, that's correct.
So starting on page 8 is the best case scenario, is in the highest returns based on Callan's forecast. And then the other two are actual returns. And all three, what we call the model breaks, which is denoted by the red bars on the top half of the bar chart there. Not to mention the surplus deficit. You've got a lot of deficit in all three. And then the effective draw rate is also in red, above 5%. So all three of these, Mr. Painter, break, which means require either an ERA draw or taxes, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes. If you make no other policy changes, then all of these would show that those deficits are large enough that you'd have to overdraw the ERA.
And cuts.
Mr. Chairman, yes. You could make other policy choices like taxes or cuts, but this is reflecting none of those, just an ERA overdraw to fill the deficit.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Senator Hoffman, you had a question, sir?
Well, a comment, I guess. You know, I think that the provision that Senator Stedman talked about on the 4 years from $1,100 to for 2 years and then $1,213 the subsequent 3 years, and we would consider the POMV increase at 50-50 if the revenues were generated, but if they weren't, that would not happen. So basically there's the it would be incumbent upon the legislature to see what revenues are going to be needed. You know, I think that the primary difference between this plan and the current Senate Bill 53 is that this is stair-stepping from an affordable stance versus trying to set up the bridge funding that was alluded to earlier by this Finance Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Painter, please continue.
Okay, so...
The end result, I would say, is both of those plans call for a 50-50 payout in dividends for the people of Alaska.
Mr. Painter?
So continuing on to slide 11, so this essentially shows what would happen with the same PFD scenario, but then adding $700 million of new revenue starting in FY26. So essentially when that PFD amount goes up to the 50-50 plan, there would be the $700 million of new revenue to support that. And that results in essentially balanced budgets in that period. So the deficit had been a bit over $700 million before in the first scenario. This is now showing roughly a balanced budget in FY26. And again, that very small overdraw in FY23 could be avoided with using ARPA revenue replacement. So essentially this would be the scenario if you go through this proposal and put in the revenue to support the higher dividend level.
Thank you. Senator Stedman?
Mr. Chairman, I think one man's revenue is the next man's taxes. So I understand what side of the coin I'll be on. I'll be on the tax end as a citizen. So anyway, I find when they always say new revenue, it'd be clearer, with a footnote that say we're going to increase taxes or have budgetary reductions or a combination of both. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Were you finished, Senator Stedman? Mm-hmm. Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a comment?
No.
No. I'd just like to say, we're looking at $700 million in new revenue, taxes. It's new money. But also, we saw the working group's report. So there could be room for $250 million worth of cuts in there too. So you could lower that revenue number if you can find the $250 million. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. All modeling is generally stat or stagnant, if you will, or it's two-dimensional. What's missing here is the economic consequences of taking $700 million out of the economy in one form, such as business potential, investment potential, and returning it as a dividend. What does that do to the economy? Is it good? Is it bad? Does it expand? Does it contract? Does it attract new investment? What is the long-term economic consequence? We had the census that just came out, and the behavior that the state has done thus far has resulted in a population decline, a brain drain. We have a smaller population. People are leaving. Do we want to continue that trend, or do we want to reverse it?
Thank you. Mr. Painter, you want to continue, please?
Mr. Chairman, the next slide, slide 12, shows that same scenario, but with the FY 2000 through 2008 actual returns. And so once again, that reduces the budget, the revenue in starting in FY24. In this scenario with the $700 million of new revenue, there it still is a roughly balanced budget, FY26 and beyond, but instead of generating surpluses after that, it stays in that roughly balanced zone. Again, the ERA dips, but then begins to recover in the later years.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, please continue.
Going on to slide 13, so this shows that, again, the same policy scenario with FY09 through 17 returns. And so with this, with the larger drop to the permanent fund, the deficits persist even with the new revenue. So there would be deficits that persist through FY27 and then, you know, roughly balanced beyond then. And so in contrast to the others, this has overdraws from the ERA to meet the deficit in several years in the, even once the new revenue kicks in.
Senator Stedman.
This is a reminder, Mr. Chairman, in this time frame, 09 to 17, we had to call the Great Recession, biggest recession we ever had relative to the Great Depression. So it's hopefully something we never see again. But it was there, so it was modeled, because it's most likely the worst case we'd ever see, we hope.
I was hoping one of the two co-chairs would talk about a little history when they were both here at the table in 08, 09, or 10, when we didn't know if you were going to be able to pay a dividend. Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a time when we had a substantial budget reduction reflected in this time frame, and the way the dividend is calculated under the statutory formula, there was a concern that there was no funds available to pay a dividend. Some of us to this day feel that the permanent fund actively turned over the portfolio to create realized returns and income to produce a dividend to the people. Although they don't admit it, that's my personal opinion, watching it walk into it and then through it and then after the fact. But there was significant concern at this table that there would be no dividends to the people because of the market conditions and the way the formula was created. The way this formula is created and the one we're currently operating under the 5% payout of the permanent fund, if the permanent fund does have a substantial decrease in value, we still pay out the five-year percentage over the, because we use a look back of 5 years and average of returns. So we have eliminated that possibility in the future, but that was accurate, Mr. Chairman. It was a reality at this table a decade ago or so.
Thank you, and that's the goal of the legislature, is to try to make sure that never happens again. And whatever we do, we need to be prudent to make sure that we get it as accurate as we can. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going on to slide 14, so this shows the stair step, but then if the revenue does not come in, and the result would be then that the dividend formula reverts to $1,300 PFD growing with inflation rather than the 50-50. So in this scenario with the Callan returns, essentially there would be a budget surplus starting FY25 of projected to be $176 million and growing in the future years. So obviously no need for ERA overdraws in those later years.
Questions? Please continue, Mr. Painter.
Okay, the next version, slide 15, again, the same policy scenario, but this time with the actual returns from FY 2000 through 2008. So once again, similar pattern in the ERA, and still no overdraws, although the surpluses are a bit smaller than in the previous scenario.
Thank you. Please continue.
Then in the FY 09 through 17, Like the last scenario with this same return, scenario, this shows persistent deficits for a longer period, and then it still balances the budget and results in surpluses by the very end of the modeling period. But in the meantime, the ERA would essentially vanish in FY25 due to some of these overdraws to get through these years. So in this scenario, even with the $1,300 PFD in this return scenario, that does result in overdraws.
Senator Stedman?
No, good point.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Wilson, are you next? Thank you.
So thank you. So it looks like with three models, this last one, the 2009-2017, is still pretty tight, or actually breaks with the all the way through 2027 negative numbers. And even with the other one, 2000 and page 15, it's very skinny for a while, if you will. It's very small surpluses. This is assuming nearly break even or deficit, so not much for capital, not much for deferred maintenance, not a lot of room for inflation. This is assuming, I believe, at the very beginning, you were talking about the governor's assumptions of volume for the next 8 years. Does the recent permit effect from the federal government on Willow, I believe, do you think that materially impacts the potential volume estimates for the future?
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff, that would make some impact. The way Department of Natural Resources does their production forecast, they do apply sort of an assumption that there's some risk of any new production. So it wasn't 100% assuming that it was going to happen in the forecast year anyway. So I think the impact of this court decision is not as great as if they had assumed that it was certainly going to come on in the year that it was projected.
Just one follow-up. So what we're doing in this is modeling the green, which is the permanent fund, but we're not really modeling the blue, which is the revenue. And that's still about 25% to 30% or so of our income. And perhaps, Mr. Chairman, someday it might make sense to kind of model the blue on a high, medium, and low estimates, because that could materially pile on the deficits. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Painter, a couple of questions. Through slides 11 through 13, where we talked about the new revenue, and we asked this question sort of yesterday to about sort of the contingency language in a bill that's in this committee. If the ERA is statutory, if it's set, would Lynch Finance consider additional overdraw to be new revenue?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think the contingency language hopefully would define new revenue to clarify whether that would be the case. You could say that the new revenue cannot include that. If you would like it to not include that, you can say that the new revenue must consist of taxes, or must consist of, you know, taxes and fees, or whatever mix of new revenue you'd prefer. I think we would prefer, legislative finance would prefer, not to be in the position of having to try to interpret legislative intent. We would much prefer if, in crafting that language, the legislature made it clear whether an overdraw of the ERA or a higher draw from the ERA would count or not.
But if I could, as it stands now, what would be the interpretation of finance without any clarity from the legislature?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm not sure how we would interpret that. I think the higher draw, because it's not ongoing and would not really affect the years in which the dividend would be higher. Those would be in the first couple of years. And so I think it would be ambiguous at best about whether that would count. And I think we'd have to consider it carefully. And I guess because it's a live bill, I would just encourage you to clarify now, because I do not know how we would choose to categorize that in the future.
Thank you. If I could ask another question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I guess similarly for these models, it seems that your first model of the Calends are sort of your high, and your years, you have a mean range would be your years 2000, 2008, and your low scenario would be 09 through 017. But I guess this is a question for the committee to consider, as starting this with a reversal of, let's start with the 50-50% of market value and sort of good faith to the people of Alaska, that's our intention and goal, then go to a lower scenario to back to that level, just as, in good faith and compromise. And I guess if I could ask the committee for, or maybe Ledge Finance, to give to the committee a modeling that would show something similar to that, and what that would look like going to starting off with the 50-50 first, and then going back to other years in perpetuity, just to have a little bit more of a good faith compromise going forth.
Sure. Mr. Painter, Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to put some clarity on this issue, on definitions. So I go home to my wife and I tell her, honey, I love you a lot. I got new revenue. Here's $10,000. And I didn't tell her I took it out of the savings account. I probably have a frying pan alongside my head. It's a pretty far stretch to call overdrawing the permanent fund new revenue and classify it as new revenue. Heck, we'd just overdraw it every year and always have a balanced budget. So we need to be very clear when we're talking about new revenue. It's tax collections. It could be, higher advancing oil price and oil volume. And then budget reductions. We all know we're sitting on about a $4.5 billion operating budget since 2015 that we haven't been able to move down much. That includes statewide. That's over three governors at the end of Parnell's last year and four legislatures, including this one. So there won't, I doubt very much if there'll be 200 million. No one's come forward with 200 million or 150 million in reductions yet that have stuck. And the last few years, it's not there. So it's going to be significantly weighted to new revenue, which is taxes. And we'll be working with those issues here at the table going forward. But trying to redefine overdraws of the permanent fund as new revenue, I don't think the public's going to buy that at all.
Well, just to put another finer point on putting finer points, we'll have to ask the administration, are they going to continue to be agnostic towards taxes? Because without that, none of this works. So, any other questions before we conclude today's meeting? Senator Stedman?
Just for clarification, this is not, there's no language in here to put this in the Constitution as yet. The committee hasn't obviously had the CS on the table and hasn't taken amendments, but that's not in here. So in the event that whatever we come up with we have issues with it, future legislatures can adjust it, tweak it, or do whatever. Senator Von Imhoff has stated, modeling's modeling. We do the best we can, but we don't know what's coming at us. We might have, rosier years, or we might have some, a decade of stagnation. So we need to have some flexibility. And I will say there's not a lot of flexibility in this. We're trying to maximize the dividend flow to the people, given a $700 million tax increase, roughly. And have some flexibility so the legislature can adjust to current economic conditions. And I think it's a starting point, Mr. Chairman. This is not the ending point. Thank you.
Seeing no further comments, Mr. Painter, you're finished?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for coming in on a Saturday. Our next meeting will be announced. So stay tuned, and we are gaveled out at 3:05.